was hacked or defeated, I should say, in probably I think it was less than a day. And it wasn't really that earth-shattering of a hack. It was effectively a way to pick up a latent fingerprint by whoever it was that you wanted to, get into their device. You take their latent fingerprint and then you just transfer it to a piece of, I think it was some sort of a medium. I don't remember if it was just some tape or an actual kind of a gelatinous medium. Anyways, so you transfer it and then whammo, there it was. So, it's and that's just one method. Corey Knockreiner's article was actually talking about gummy bears and how you can use gummy bears to defeat fingerprint readers, and how you can defeat iris scanners and facial recognition scanners, and you can even use a 3D printer to print yourself a mask of someone else that you have photographs of. And then, of course, run around in the world as if you're them. And that is good enough to defeat facial recognition scanning. Now, of course, this also means then that that's good enough to defeat what's called Windows Hello, which is this whole idea that supposedly it's somehow more secure for you to walk up to your computer and your computer has a webcam, or maybe it's a tablet or a laptop that has an integrated webcam, and then you just walk up to it and it sees your face, and then it says, "Oh, well, I know that you're the person who's supposed to be using this camera," and then it, or this laptop, and then it unlocks. So somehow that's supposed to be more secure than a password that resides exclusively in your brain. Now, clearly, I mean, we could make an argument one way or the other. If somebody is using a very weak password and they never change it, and they have otherwise bad security practices, well, with regards to someone remotely gaining access to their computer and then being able to exploit things, maybe Windows Hello is more secure in that perspective, but certainly not in a perspective that someone who actually wants to gain access to your computer actually has a photograph of you and an ability to pretend that they are you, either using a 3D printer or other sort of facial recognition means. The same thing applies with fingerprint. Right, this the whole idea of biometric, and same thing applies with iris scanners as well. So I've got this article linked, and you can definitely check it out if you want. But there's another aspect to this whole issue, which is that there are no Fifth Amendment protections against anything that can be biometrically defeated. The United States Supreme Court has already judged that if you have to produce a fingerprint or an iris scan or facial recognition or anything like that in order to unlock a device so that law enforcement can do whatever they want with it. You have no Fifth Amendment protections against that because they can force you to put your finger on the device or to stand in front of the device or to have your iris scanned. That is now law of the land that you have no Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination because of that. So I'm a big fan of the things that are exclusively sitting inside of your memory, because that seems to be the only thing that we have any sort of constitutional protections over at this point in time, is the things that are exclusively in your memory. And I think just the technology doesn't exist in a widespread manner at this point that would allow them to put your head in a scanner and to scan your memories and to force you to give up passwords. Clearly there's things like enhanced interrogation that could be used, I suppose, but that's not being used in general at places like, Border Patrol. Okay. So I thought it was a very interesting article with regards to the fallacy and the fakeness of the supposed security that you're getting because of using biometric authentication. So it's really just baloney. as usual. All right. The next one, it happens to be on Amazon Echo and Alexa. Specifically, Amazon Echo Spot is now being marketed by Amazon as having a smart alarm feature, and they really want you to put it next to your bed, facing it directly at you. So if you're going to do something like this, you need to understand that Amazon Echo Spot, as well as Amazon Echo and Alexa, all have microphones. They all have cameras. They're on all the time. Inherently, the way that these devices work is that they are actively listening to everything that is going on all the time. So if you think about how Alexa works as an example, you can tell it, you know, Alexa, play music, and it'll play your music. And you can tell it, Alexa, stop, and okay. And so of course, the only way that this can work is if it is listening to you all the time. Now, all of this traffic that's going between this device and the Amazon servers is questionable in terms of its security. And I can pretty well guarantee you that the NSA is copying all of that data. Why? Well, because we've known for the last 20 years here that the NSA tapped the literal internet backbone. And that's what's happening out in Bluffdale, Utah, where all this data is just getting stored and analyzed. The degree to which it's being analyzed is debatable. But James Clapper made it very clear that the NSA's intention was to bulk capture everything. The revelations of Edward Snowden made it apparent that that is actually what's happening. Then we have Bill Binney and Thomas Drake, multiple people that have been insiders, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, have all confirmed that that's actually what's going on. So the question I have for you is, why would you spend money to buy a device that is then going to listen to everything that's going on in your house, in your private spaces, your most private spaces? Why would you buy that device and put it in your bedroom? I mean, the place that you most likely really don't want to be spied upon, because what happens in your bedroom is supposed to stay in your bedroom. So then why would you get an Amazon Echo Spot and effectively buy a device that is going to be used to spy on you? Now, even if you think to yourself, well, I'm totally comfortable with the government having a copy of everything that I do because supposedly I have nothing to hide, which I think is actually a very naive interpretation of that. But aside from that, what about all of these Internet of Things devices that have been, that continue to be, and probably always will be hacked by hackers? So again, I say, do you really want to put that device in your bedroom? Because if there are things that are going on inside your bedroom that you don't want on the front page of the newspaper, well, maybe you shouldn't have that device in there. Because if a hacker decides to come after that device to use it to gain information on you, photos, etc., you know, you basically bought the device and put it into your bedroom. So anyways, I've got some articles about that and I'll link those and you can check those out. But that's a question I have for you. Are you comfortable with that? Is the convenience of the Amazon, the Echo Spot so much more important? Are you willing to take the risk that some hacker will get access to that and then take all this bulk recording and stuff it on the internet and blackmail you with it and put it on the front page of the newspaper and ruin you? Is that really what you want? So I can't understand why people would buy such devices. But hey, if you're making that informed decision and you wish to do that, that's your choice. Now let's talk a little bit more about Internet of Things devices, because of course that is what Alexa and Amazon Echo Spot are, is they are things that are called the Internet of Things, otherwise known as IoT devices. And IoT devices are inherently insecure, and I expect they will probably continue to be inherently insecure for a very long time because they're not manufactured with the purpose for security. They are manufactured with the purpose for convenience and what's called end user experience. And the best way to have a high satisfaction of end user experience is to make something super, super easy. Well, the only way you make something super, super easy is by having no security, right? If you don't have to put in a username, password, if there's no security or no level of procedure involved in getting it, hooked up to the internet or keeping it secured, what about the maintenance on such a thing? In fact, most IoT manufacturers, they do a bid to software developers to design these devices initially. And then once they're brought to market, that's the end of it. I mean, the manufacturer has no methodology, and they're not paying anyone to maintain the firmware in a secure fashion on these devices. So you've now got this device that was deployed initially, and if there's any sort of updates to it, it very well just may be feature updates. And you may never ever be getting security updates for the device whatsoever because either the manufacturer isn't paying for it or it's just not part of their plan whatsoever. And if it's just not important to them because the consumer never demanded a secure device because they're just completely fine to buy these spy devices and put them in their homes. Right? So IoT devices inherently. There is no security business plan around them. And there was some talk about having a federal chief information security officer to put forward these requirements for IoT devices to have a certain set, a certain level of security. But really, I don't think that that's ever going to solve the problem. Because I mean, let's just take prostitution as a prime example of this. You can make all the federal rules and regulations you want. Fundamentally, as long as there is demand, someone is going to supply it. I mean, this is why prostitution and, well, illegal drug trafficking and everything else that's illegal still exists because there's demand for it. So unless consumers demand secure devices, the manufacturers aren't going to make them. And I can give you a converse example of how consumer demand does drive better business practices. Let's look at the whole local food movement or the whole organic food movement. I mean, it's now so much of this consumer demand for better quality food that even really large manufacturers have completely shifted massive product lines to being organic or grass-fed or pasture-raised or, sustainably raised and all of these things because that's all been driven by consumer demand. Very little of that has been based upon governmental regulations. I mean, certainly the organic food revolution has absolutely nothing to do with governmental regulations. And for that matter, the organic farm certification regulations that the USDA does is, well, it's pretty loose at best. It's pretty easy to achieve organic certification on a lot of things. So, but that's a whole nother topic. So, anyways, to kind of finish off this whole IoT device issue that you need to be aware of. Two things. Number one, James Clapper, head of the NSA, literally is testifying in front of Congress and he says, well, yeah, we're going to use these Internet of Things devices to spy on people. I mean, it's going to happen. And, if you don't believe me, then I've got some articles for you to look at and some actual video of him saying it to look at. So you can check those out on the website later. And in addition to that, the CIA actually has a hack called the Weeping Angel hack, and this was one of the multitudinous CIA hacking tools that the CIA was unable to keep under wraps and unable to keep in their book of goods. You know, they got hacked themselves, and then shadow brokers, you know, released this. So now we all know about the Weeping Angel hack amongst, you know, hundreds of other types of hacks. But this was specifically about putting your smart TV into a supposedly off state. So it, as far as you were concerned, it looked like it was off. But in reality, it was not off. It was on, and it was recording and listening. So there you have it. So, you know, how do you deal with something like that? Well, don't put a network cable into it. And really, by all means, don't buy a wireless TV. A wireless TV, you couldn't give me enough money to have a wireless TV. And with regards to, oh, well, I want my smart TV to be able to have, you know, updates. Okay, fine. Put a network cable into the back of the TV when you want it to have updates. Outside of that, take the network cable out. Or if you want to use the smart TV in order to, you know, play a movie or whatever that's streaming from this and that, fine. Put the network cable into it then. Play your movie and unplug it when you're done. There are actually little, what's called Ethernet on-off switches. Now, this is not an Ethernet switch in that is a powered switch, but it is literally like a little box that has the 8-wire pinout inside of it for Ethernet cabling, where you press this toggle button, and it's purely a mechanical device. There's no electronics inside of it at all. And it either connects those 8 wires or they're not connected. So that's also a thing that you could do when you're turning off your TV and you don't want your TV to be connected to the internet anymore. Just go up to your TV and press that little button, and voila. Now your TV does not have an internet connection when you don't want it to have an internet connection. So again, there's an Internet of Things device right there that has been very publicly. I mean, smart TVs, there's tons of articles about how smart TVs are have been used surreptitiously by the manufacturers themselves to spy on consumers. And then, of course, then there's the CIA Weeping Angel hack. And these are just the things that we know about. I have no doubt that there's plenty of other hacks for those devices that we don't know anything about. All right, on to another topic, which has to do with ransomware, but yet it also has to do with backups and business continuity. Now, I find this topic to be absolutely fascinating because none of this is new. You know, and it just, I'm flabbergasted oftentimes by how many organizations are still doing the same stupid things that they should have, you know, stopped doing 20 years ago. So a good example of that is recently there were some hospitals, one in the UK and one in Indiana, who got some ransomware, and it ended up scrambling and encrypting files that they had for their hospital. Now, instead of simply eliminating the ransomware from their environment and restoring those files from backup, each one of those hospitals ended up paying massive ransomware fees because their backup system could not recover the data within what was a recovery time objective. So I want to talk a little bit about this whole concept of recovery time objective because it's so crucial. And again, none of this is, it's not rocket science. We've been doing this for more than 20 years. I mean, this should be at this point so brain dead, stupid, simple, easy that no organization should be falling prey to this. But still yet we see all the time where organizations are paying for ransomware fees because they either can't restore their files or they can't restore them within time. So fundamentally, you know that your backup system is faulty when it does not allow for backup and restore within what is called the recovery time window. And that recovery time window is the very first step in engineering a system. So when you are engineering anything, a server, a network connection, an email system, a hospital information system, I don't care really what it is. The very first thing you have to start with, because it's going to drive so much of the engineering design of it, is stating what is our recovery time objective for this system. So if you have effectively a almost zero downtime recovery time objective, you end up doing things like what a lot of banks do, where they have completely hot failover systems. You know, there was a bank that was inside of the World Trade Center when one of the buildings went down. And in this process, they had something like a 4-second delay, and it flipped over to their data center that was in, I believe it was in New Jersey. So clearly they stated what their recovery time objective was, and then they put in an engineered designed system that would meet that, and then obviously tested it and made it work. Well, the same thing has to apply for everyone. And clearly there is a cost profile to this, but people need to be making informed decisions. And what I see more often than not going on is that local IT consulting firms are not having that conversation with business owners. So that conversation doesn't happen. And then at the same time, some business owners just balk at the price of anything that actually matches what they state their lack of willingness for an outages. So that is a pretty good conversation that needs to happen, and then it needs to be documented and written, and then you need to actually have a system that has the capacity for that. And with regards to capacity, I'll tell you something that's almost completely free to do. It's so easy. I've been doing it for ever since people have been getting servers, really. If you design enough capacity into a server, you can have snapshots multiple times per day. So imagine a scenario where you get ransomware at 3 p.m., but you had a snapshot at 2 p.m. Now you can have that snapshot because your server has the space and the capacity to have that snapshot. But what if the server design was exclusively this idea of like, well, servers don't need to cost that much. You know, so now we're literally talking about you could have gotten ahead of the problem and paid a little bit more for a server to have a little bit more storage capacity so you could have had adequate numbers of snapshots. But instead, when you do get this ransomware or you do have some sort of a problem that causes that current data set that's there on the server to not be acceptable anymore and you feel like you want to roll back to a prior point in time, the question is, can you do that? Well, you can't unless you've got adequate numbers of snapshots happening throughout the day. And you can't have those snapshots if you don't have adequate capacity engineered into the system from the beginning. So that's why I say you have to start with recovery time objective when you are choosing to design something. And it really doesn't have to cost that much. There is a fork truck and forklift company in Racine that some years ago went out of business. Basically, they went bankrupt and sold out to another company because of a variety of financial mismanagement issues. One of those financial mismanagement issues had to do with having a relationship with an IT service provider that was effectively defrauding them and was incompetent simultaneously. So they had this contract with the IT service provider, and I actually saw the contract with my own eyes. Okay, so I'm not telling you anything that is speculative here whatsoever. I read the contract myself because I was brought in to audit this. Now, in reading this contract, it said very explicitly that it would only be a maximum of 48 hours before the IT services company was able to get the forklift company back up and running. And yet when I got called in, it was more than 2.5 weeks after an outage that they had experienced, and they still had no email, they still had no file server, they could barely log into their computers. I mean, literally, they weren't doing business, right? They weren't doing business. Now, at this point in time, I think if I was in that situation, I would have sued the IT service provider. I would have certainly not paid them for anything, because it was like 2.5 weeks later, and I still wasn't back up and running, even when I had a contract with them, right? So at that point in time, I would have absolutely gotten some help from somebody else, because it was abominable. Well, nonetheless, because of this financial mismanagement, they actually went, that company went bankrupt and was bought out by another company. So, you know, clearly, if you're a business owner, you need to be having these conversations with your IT service provider. What is the recovery time objective? Explain to me the costs associated with this type of a failure or that type of a failure. Talk about what types of outages could occur and what a realistic expectation for a recovery time is in that scenario, and what a realistic expectation is for a cost profile of that recovery. There's a consulting firm in Racine that is literally selling IT services for offsite backup to their clients, and their whole plan, I kid you not, because I heard this from the president of that company directly to my ears from their lips, that their whole plan is that they literally get into a vehicle and they drive to a data center in Iowa, where the people in Iowa take that client's data and stick it on a hard drive. And then, of course, these people from Racine have to drive back from Iowa. So we're now talking about basically 14 hours are going by before a recovery can even start. Just think about that for a second. If your whole recovery time is based upon, okay, wait, we've got this outage, we've had this failure, somebody has to diagnose it and then make a decision that they got to drive to Iowa, then they got to drive to Iowa, and then they got to get the thing, and then they got to come back. And then we can't even start the recovery process until all that baloney has happened. So, you know, as a business owner, are you aware that this is the process? You can't just go on faith. You need to ask hard questions. And if you don't feel comfortable asking those hard questions, if you don't know what questions to ask, get another consulting firm in there, do an audit. But I would recommend that you get an audit from a consulting firm that is in a geographically disparate area. Don't be obsessed and enamored with this whole local service baloney. I mean, we do nationwide service, and you just do not have to have a local service provider, especially in the case of an audit. What you need to have is somebody who's going to give you an objective assessment of, you know, what your exposure is. And if you don't know, then you should find out. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
On Saturday morning, March the 10th at 11:15, it's the WGTD Radio Theater's live broadcast of Our Secret Sisters, where women serve as spies during the Second World War. The WGTD Radio Theater, March the 10th at 11:15.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Willow's Keep, one-of-a-kind baskets woven by the women of Ghana, great for shopping and for gifting. The market is open Saturdays at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha from 10 until 2. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha. Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with